Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Rick returns next Sunday. We're closing off our 2019 season here on the Wake Up Call with three stories from earlier this year. Later in this hour, we'll hear from Rich Tarbell, author of Regarding Charlottesville Music, Kirby Hateau, general manager of the Sprint Pavilion, and musician Stephen Barling of Barling & Collins about the impact local music has had on the development of the downtown mall. Also, later in the program, I'll talk with University of Virginia Director of Cybersecurity and IT Programs, Angela Orbaugh, about some of the security threats facing the Internet today and what can be done about them. But first, in September, Sunday morning wake-up call host Rick Moore talked with Reverend Tyler Daniels about modern religion, life as a pastor, and the relationship between politics and religion. Here's Rick Moore.
Reverend Tyler Daniels here with us on a Sunday to talk about modern religion and life as a pastor. And let's do some politics and religion and how they mix together. So one of the things that many people would say, and I can't give you a set percentage, is that many folks who strongly practice politics, strongly practice religion, who go to church every Sunday or frequently, don't practice what they preach, right? It's especially the more evangelical that you get. It's Jesus says this, but then they say, keep those immigrants out of our country. And so I'm just going to throw that at you and let you talk about that for a moment.
Sure. This is one of the biggest issues in the church today. Now, I'm a Southern Baptist, and every year we convene the Southern Baptist Convention, which is all of the, I forget what the number is now, I think that number is 38,000, 39,000 Southern Baptist churches. However many of them can get together, they form a deliberative body to give shape to what we're going to do cooperatively with everything we bring. Why do I talk about that? Because when you get 5 or 8 or 12,000 Baptists in one room, you see the spectrum, not necessarily the spectrum of political holdings, but the spectrum of the way that people want to see those things cross over with the life and the ministry of the church. And so you can see it in any individual Baptist church or in our larger bodies. What I am seeing when I look at it at Piney Fork Church and in all the ways that we cooperate is that we have a really hard time telling the difference between what are the convictions of our faith and what are our political opinions. Political opinions are something in this free society that we are given the right to. And we are grateful for the right to vote. We are thankful that you can still stand up and say yes to some things, no to some others, and vote accordingly. Some choose to hold those as totally separate from their faith convictions. Not that they would say vote or choose something that is diametrically opposed to their beliefs, but instead that they would be willing to say do things politically or believe things politically that maybe are not as clear biblically, but they're comfortable enough drawing a little bit of a dashed line between the two and saying, those two things don't always have to add up. Then there are others who, because of what they hold according to the faith, it drives everything they do politically. Anything that falls outside of the bounds of how they believe God's word and seek to apply it in their lives, they're not going to do anything politically that would be counter to that. We are in a really interesting age for the church in today's political climate, because historically you really could do some things, at least over the last generation or so, where you really could kind of sort of say, well, one political party is sort of kind of the evangelical Christian preferred political party. And those who are at the head of the party, they're the ones that evangelical conservative Christians are going to feel okay voting for. Some of that is a little more nuanced than it used to be. Not every conservative evangelical Christian feels so closely tied to one political party and those who are leading the party. Which gives us the question then of where do those people turn when it comes to an understanding of politics? So take, for instance, someone like me. You know, for me, I am one whose faith convictions, right? one who's, just as Jesus taught us, one whose yes is yes and whose no is no. One who lets the Bible be the framework for what he believes and chooses. Politically, if it falls outside the bounds of that, or if the people who are leading the charge fall outside the bounds of that, then I'm going to address it biblically and not politically. I'm going to say, well, then this is outside of what I believe, and so I can't possibly vote this way, whether it's about moral issues or political issues or whatever. There are others who don't quite feel the same way that I do. They believe that you can uphold your belief, your firm belief in the scriptures, but that their responsibility as an American is to vote a particular way, choose a particular way that upholds their American sensibilities, their political sensibilities, what might be best for the nation. The idea that conservative Christianity and conservative politics always cross over doesn't hold as true anymore, at least not in my personal experience. Talking with other faith leaders, talking with leaders in our own denomination, there is a much more critical view there than maybe there has been in the last generation. That's not what you see mostly on Facebook. You know, when you see individual believers from individual churches who are loudly trumpeting what they believe politically, usually through
trumpeting.
Yes, that was a word that I used, and yeah,
not a capital T. Just
I didn't say anything. But what happens is we distill everything down to memes and shareable pictures and little pithy quotes, and that becomes sort of the political banner that we wave. And some people do that way too quickly, without carefully assessing what it means in the Bible. Now, as a pastor, I try as best I'm able, usually in our smaller settings where we can have dialogue, I try to make sure that we are teaching and addressing some of these things and doing it carefully and biblically, not just doing it to uphold things that we already think are true or wish were true. Now, on a Sunday morning, we tend to have a sort of broader focus, and it's less of a dialogue. It's more of the pastor trying to explicate what's in the passages of the scripture. And that is usually all invitation. It's here's the gospel of Jesus. We want you to know how it can reshape your life. We want you to come to faith. And so we do that as broadly as we can on Sunday mornings. When we sit down in dialogue around the table or on a Wednesday night Bible study, that's when I try to make sure that we address some of these cultural things that are going on and to do it thoughtfully and biblically. So to go back to the top, with the illustration, not the illustration, the real-life example that you gave, say, of immigration. When I talked about it in our church, the way that I expressed it is, regardless of your holdings politically, because you're permitted in this country to believe politically what you believe, to vote how you feel like you should vote, if you're going to vote for firmer borders, if you are going to vote for more boundaries, if you're going to vote for an immigration crackdown, you're permitted to do that. But when we've got refugees, people who are in need, folks who are fleeing from what at least they are telling us, dangerous, violent things, the church, regardless of what happens politically, the church should be the first ones there on the ground seeking to feed, clothe, care for. I believe, and it's sort of a radical notion, I believe that so many of these things that we wish we could solve governmentally, not borders and border patrols, but I'm talking about the care of those who are coming across. I firmly believe the church, if we were just given free license to take it over, I think the church could do it better than the government could, because we would come to it with a different level of compassion and hope and hopefulness for those who are coming. Now, I say all that I pastor a church in the country west of Gretna, Virginia, near Smith Mountain Lake, where nobody's crossing the border to come to us. But I partner denominationally with thousands of churches who are in position to be able to minister to those who come. And so for us, the care of people, compassion, that is absolutely urgent. And so regardless of how you vote politically, that's your great privilege in America, and we're thankful for it. But the church needs to be doing the things that the church is designed to do, the care of others, explicitly so we can come and deliver the good news of Jesus to them. If we believe that folks have to believe that message, if that is the one decision a person needs to make, to place their faith and trust in Jesus, believe on him, confess him as Lord, if we believe that, and if God has said go to them, then we should be the first in line to go to them with whatever we have to give.
Again, our guest today is Reverend Tyler Daniels. He's the pastor at Piney Fork Baptist Church in Gretna, Virginia. I feel lucky to have him today. So go back to a couple things you said in that answer. I'm curious about if you have different issues that come up with one candidate. You're trying to follow them biblically, make your decisions biblically, and one is pro-life and pro-choice, and the other is build your borders and help the immigrants. How do you apply your faith to that?
Yeah, and this is where almost all of the complication comes in, because if you're looking for, we talk about Christian candidates. The vast majority of people running for public office will claim some kind of Christian.
Oh, I heard ties. I heard the line. I think I heard it three different times this past week, knowing that you were coming, from different people, called the spiritual war. Or, you know, just the new phrase. I don't know. So
sure. Well, yeah. Well, when we talk about the idea of spiritual warfare, there's a biblical and a faith side to that. Particularly when we talk about usually our battle against sin and self, and we talk about the lies that we can fall for and the way that it can take someone away from and out of the faith, and that's very real. But when we apply those words to say things that are happening culturally, politically, well, yeah, there are things that are not true, things that are being upheld culturally and politically, that are an affront to biblical Christianity. Not that Christians stand ready to be offended, and if that's our position in the world where it's like, you know, you offend me, we're missing the point of where we should be standing in the faith. Anyway, but these issues that we deal with as far as what presents challenge for a Christian, challenge is not always spiritual warfare. Difficulty is not always spiritual warfare. And so with these, the idea of political candidates, you know, holding in tension the fact that while some will take the name Christian and say, well, I'm a Christian candidate, or they'll affirm their ties to a Christian church. When you look at the bullet points on their website or on the flyers they mail out or whatever, and you say, okay, well, I agree with that, and that seems to jibe with the truth of the scriptures, and then, oh boy, I don't agree with that, and then this one I've never even really thought about before. What we find is that when you look at all of the candidates, there is not one clear candidate who stands for and upholds all of the things that a person who is a convictional, we'll say Bible-believing Christian, there's not one candidate that person can say, yeah, they're getting it all right. Which means that come election time, this is a really complicated idea, it stinks. there's not always a right answer. I remember particularly in our family, we were talking about candidates a few election cycles ago. And the clearest candidate for us to vote for based on how we believe and the things that we hold politically, the clearest candidate was also somebody that we had a deep disagreement with as far as faith is concerned, what they call Christianity and how they chose to practice it. And we said, well, that's not us, and worse than it not being us, it's not Bible. And so we've got a problem there, because this is the candidate who stands for all of the things that we believe convictionally. Here's one who does believe that life begins at conception. Here's one who does uphold the whole sanctity of human life, not just from conception, but also all the way into elder years, and on down the line for the bullet points. But we have a deep disagreement on the Christian faith itself. Well, what do we do then? Do we vote for the candidate who seems to check all the boxes, but who we're not even entirely sure they're praying to the right God? That's difficult. I know that the overwhelming majority of what we would call conservative evangelical Christians, that they have voted for and continue to support the current president. But there's also more than enough folks who are inside those conservative evangelical circles who also have deep questions about moral issues and about things that are said and done. And all of that has to be in the picture.
Reverend, a question. I'm curious what you think about your thoughts on the current presidential administration.
Of the United States of America?
Yes.
Yeah, great question.
President Trump.
With President Trump, you have a man who... What else can be said that hasn't been said already?
You haven't said it.
I haven't said it. Okay. And remember, I'm not running for anything, and I'm pretty sure my church will welcome you home. But Piney Fork Church, feel free to turn off the podcast anytime. No, when you think about the current... When I think about the current presidential administration... Here's where you see the conflict lived out, and not just lived out, but writ large. You have a character who stands very obviously in the culture. This is not a quiet or a subtle person, and this is not someone whose thoughts are guarded. They're out there for everyone, which means that if you assess not just where he stands politically, because, again, he checks a lot of boxes for the conservative evangelical Christian. As far as being pro-life, as far as, again, moving on down the line of the things that he has stood for. But also you have some pretty significant moral and worldview questions. And any thoughtful Christian is going to look to that and say, this at least deserves more careful thought and prayer than just saying, well, he's at the head of the Republican Party and I'm going to vote. And so for me personally, I try to be on the thoughtful Christian side. And so we carefully assess that. We pray for the man. You know, we pray for this country. It's a great place to live. I'm so thankful by God's grace I'm an American. And so having done all that, we try to be wise.
You've been listening to Sunday Morning Wake Up Call host Rick Moore's conversation with Reverend Tyler Daniels about modern religion, life as a pastor, and the relationship between politics and religion. On this, our season finale, we're taking a look back at three of our stories from 2019. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. After the break, Rich Tarbell, author of Regarding Charlottesville Music, Kirby Hateau, general manager of the Sprint Pavilion, and musician Stephen Barling of Barling & Collins talk about the impact of local music on the development of the downtown mall. Please stay with us. In May, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call host Rick Moore talked with Rich Tarbell, author of Regarding Charlottesville Music, Kirby Hateau, general manager of the Sprint Pavilion, and musician Stephen Barling of Barling & Collins, about the impact of local music on the development of the downtown mall. Once again, here's Rick Moore.
I am Rick Moore, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, doing our own thing today about music, the history of Charlottesville music. Regarding Charlottesville music, several guests in the studio. Rich Tarbell here.
Good morning, Rick.
How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for walking over.
Yeah,
is that what
close
it was
to it.
From
pretty
the
close.
Place in the back?
Yeah.
Your new book, somewhat new anyway, Regarding Charlottesville Music and Oral History. So we're going to let you go oral for an hour.
Right. Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it, happy to be back here in the studios, and happy to have a couple guests alongside me that brought along.
Yeah, we're going to have Stephen Barling here from Barling and Collins. Also a former writer, still former.
Yes, I don't write for Siebel anymore.
No, known as the Cripsy Duck.
That's right.
And we're going to get into that within the hour as well. We also have Kirby Hutto, who's the GM at Sprint Pavilion.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also helped get that Fridays After Five going. Now the thing.
Many years ago, yes.
Many years ago. People always want to see what's coming up this Friday, looking ahead in the calendar to see where they need to be or what sort of music they need to be planning to dance to on their Friday. So that's what we've got for the hour. Be prepared. Get ready so that you can know what you're going to be learning about history of Charlottesville music. Rich, your book, you can buy it in that beautiful large copy you have on your side of the counter, full of photos, beautiful photos. Who helped you put that together?
I self-published that. So that is that was a project I took on. It was my when I started this in 2017. It was my 30th year in town, and I wanted to do something photography related and music related. That's what I do. That's what I'm passionate about. So I came up with this idea of doing portraits of local musicians, and had two kind of connotations with that. One, did it in their own creative spaces just to, A, give them a comfort level, and B, make it very simple to do in one space with one light, and very portable for me. So as I did that, I was thinking, is this interesting? Where are we going with this? I couldn't really figure it out. I just wanted to do it. And I had them. So I didn't just photograph my friends. I had started with two people who I kind of consider the matriarch and patriarch of the Charlottesville music scene to me, is Jamie Dyer, the Hogwaller Ramblers, and Terry Allard. And I had them, I photographed them, and then I asked them for two names of who to photograph next. And I kind of worked my way with that roadmap. And then, so it wouldn't just kind of be that, I hate to call Terry Allard old, or we can call Jamie Dyer old, but so it wasn't just the older musicians. I started a similar thing with younger people, which was Coda Curl from Chamomile and Whiskey, and Sally Rose of Shagwolf and Sally Rose Band, and had them pick two people too. So I kind of a roadmap started at two ends of the Charlottesville music scene, the younger and the older. And that gave me the names of who to go to. And each person I photographed, I said, can you give me two more names? And that's how I came up with, it ended up being 110, 112 people that I photographed. But the second person I photographed was Sandy Gray from the Hogwild Ramblers. And we did his picture in like 5 minutes, and it was perfect. And he started telling me all these stories about the old days of him playing at the Prism on Rugby Road, the old Prism. And just fascinating stuff to me. And I said, can I turn my phone on and just record some of these stories just for prosperity's sake? And he's like, sure. So we were done his portrait in 5 minutes, and we talked for 55 minutes. And that's where I had the idea to maybe pair the photographs with an oral history. And that's really how that just organically started.
Kirby and Stephen, you both have gone through the book. Yes. Nodding oh, yeah. your head doesn't do any good now, Stephen.
They can't see that on the air?
No. So, Stephen, how many of these folks have you played with? Because Charlottesville is known for, I'll use the word organic, it's already been tossed out there, organically playing with musicians, playing with other musicians, because you play in many bands, or because you hop up on stage with one another, or you end up at somebody's house on the porch playing with somebody. And Kirby, because you have been booking bands for a lot of your professional life, how many of these musicians have you worked with? So
Steve, I mean, I've played with various handfuls of them, but I'm familiar with 85% of them. I mean, a lot of them are local standbys for years, and you know, the classics and new up and coming people who you check out when you get a chance. But you know, it's we do get around. Charlottesville does share a lot of stages, and you know, I know them all pretty much.
And both of you are in this book as well with your stories, Kirby.
You know, I've been aware of most of the people in there, but what was fascinating was the stories that Rich found that had never hit my radar. I mean, just, you know, sort of what we were talking before we started, the concentric circles, you know, where you're within your circle and you know, you're aware of the others, and then there's still some groups out there that, you know, you just never heard of or saw. But as far as booking, gosh, I probably have booked, you know, 70% of the people in there over the years, you know, starting from fraternity parties in the late 70s, 80s, up through, you know, the beginnings of Fridays After Five in the early 90s to now with the Pavilion and the continuation of Fridays After Five. So, you know, it's great to have seen all the various kind of collaborations over the years. You mentioned Sandy Gray. Good God, man. He was one of the first people I saw play when I came to Charlottesville in the fall of 76. With the band Ham and Eggs, who were fabulous. And you know, then he's been in Hogwild Ramblers, played with the All-Stars back for a while. So, you know, sort of following all those threads through is what's so fascinating. And this book is the first that anybody's made a serious effort to sort of pull it all together. So kudos to Rich for that.
You're here.
Thank you.
And we'll mention this throughout the hour, the book itself. Where can we find this?
The book, you can get it on my website, richtarbell.com. It's available in paperback or hardcover. The hardcover is a little expensive. It's a photography book. It's like a wedding book. It's 300 pages, full color. It's not cheap, but it is. That's what it has to be, unfortunately, because the production is so high and it's self-published. I'm only making, you know, a few hundred copies. The paperback's $20. That has the complete oral history and then a couple pictures that I just selected from the book. Just kind of help with narrative more than anything. The book is also available at New Dominion Bookshop downtown. The downtown mall has both the hardcover and the paperback. And then some other select places around Charlottesville have the paperback, like Plan 9, where I think you went.
Yeah, I got mine at Plan 9 right across exactly. From WPVC.
Right, and Mincer's has some copies. I just had to restock and restock them because they had run out and they were... and Sidetracks has some copies, too, downtown.
Very nice. Again, so you you can pick this up regarding Charlottesville music and oral history by Rich Tarbell. So let's talk about one of the ongoing topics throughout the book are the venues. So let's talk about some of the venues that come out in the book. There's the historical and the unique aspects. Let's talk about some of the historical aspects. Prism Coffee House was already mentioned.
Right.
What role did that play in the history of Charlottesville music?
Wow. The fact that I never went to the Prism Coffee House in the 70s when I was in town is one of the big regrets. I was an ATO fraternity brother, literally across Gordon Avenue from the Prism. We were a rock and blues house, and through tremendous live music parties, we kind of looked down on the Prism Coffee House. Well, you don't want to go there.
You were right across the street.
Literally right across the street. But then you look at who they brought to town. I mean, Emmylou Harris, 50 Cent cover in like 1977 or 78. You know, just tremendous talent on the national level, you know, who came through that little room. You know, by the time I finally discovered it and respected it, you know, it was in the, I guess, probably the late 80s. And, you know, it would still, you can just go there and be, you know, it's like, so-and-so is really playing the Prism?
That was the thing about the Prism, was that these acts who were booking 1,000-seat rooms would come and play the 50-seat Prism because it was this really intimate environment where they could really get close to their audience. And they'd do these rarity shows at the Prism for some reason.
Yeah, so, I mean, that was, that kind of was the you know, one of the outlets to bring in the larger names. And I think it was just really underappreciated at the time, certainly by me.
There's also a lot of notoriety went in the book, went to the mine shaft.
Right. The mine shaft was, what I guess, is that the Draftsman Hotel they just built? It was underneath Studio Art, for those people before
the time. Yeah, it's the Draftsman.
The Draftsman Hotel is that kind of orange trimmed building hotel there near the corner. Mine Shaft was located underneath Studio Art, which was a business that was there forever. And that was open 7 days a week. And that was your venue where it had national acts occasionally, like especially bands, I guess, going from D.C. to Atlanta or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they could stop in Muddy Waters or whatever, would stop in on a Sunday night and do the Mine Shaft as a place to get between the two. As a fill-in or whatever. But you also had your Skipcasters doing, what, every Monday night there for several years?
For ages, yeah. I mean, that was...
But it opened 7 days a week and people playing every night, basically. And, that one of... Trax was maybe more known because it is a bigger space, bigger people, or more people, bigger bands. But the Mineshaft seemed to be the one place that kind of is right in everybody's wheelhouse for that nostalgia era of... That was my best times. Those were the greatest times. But really, if you look at some of the pictures in my book that I got from Chuck Taylor, who's an amazing photographer, who was doing stuff in the 70s, Mine Shaft is kind of a dump.
It was a dump.
My memory.
It was a death trap dump.
It was a dump.
Because it was in the basement of the building. There was one stairwell going down. At some point, the building inspectors made Leon put a second fire exit on the backside. But he always locked the door. So, I mean, if anything ever went wrong in that room, you were a goner. But, boy, I mean, the walls would sweat. You know, seeing people like Muddy Waters, Robert Palmer, some of the great New Orleans bands, the Radiators, the place would just be jammed. I mean, it was literally at the point where you could not physically fit another body in and just rocking out. It was wonderful.
Well, let's move to the downtown mall itself, the mall that was the road that was blocked off. How did the music scene help the mall grow? I mean, we have Kirby Hutto here, the general manager of Sprint Pavilion. We have Stephen Barling here, who wrote for the Seaville Weekly, who's office is planted on the downtown mall, and the writing that was done, certainly a lot of musicians come out and play in the restaurants that are now on the downtown mall. How does the music scene help the downtown mall grow? If not in the 70s, certainly in the second half of the 80s and the 90s, I would think.
You know, I was hired to run Fridays After Five in 92. Now, it had already been going for a couple of years, but they were booking mainly corporate bands from out of town.
Wedding bands.
Wedding bands.
Cover bands.
Yeah, you know. You know, the whole event was kind of iffy. I mean, they were, you know, it was the cheapest beer in town on a Friday night. So you're getting the people who want the cheapest beer in town on
it
a Friday night.
It reminded me of what... When I went to school, and probably any of you three who went to UVA, reminded me of Grad Happy Hour.
A little bit,
Grad
yeah.
Happy Hour, yeah, that yeah. was awesome. Yeah, absolutely. It was that loose, right?
Well, there was nothing special about it. And, you know, when I was hired, one of the things that I said in the interview is, why are you paying all these out-of-town bands when you've got such great local talent here in town that is desperate for a larger stage to play on? And so, you know, and from the next several years when I ran it, we really shifted that focus to booking the local talent and giving them a chance to play in front of, you know, a pretty good-sized crowd. And it really started to bring people downtown in the evening hours that otherwise there was not an attraction for. And, you know, I think that at that point, you know, some of the other entrepreneurs and artistic people who had businesses realized, hey, we can start doing more music. And, You know, I think it did. It kind of jump-started things to shift the focus of the downtown area from a 9-to-5 retail into a more of an entertainment and arts and dining district, which is what you see down there now. You know, it took a while, but you finally got that critical mass of, you know, nighttime attractions to where people, you know, you're not having to make this big effort to go downtown. It's like, well, let's go downtown and see what's going on, which is a completely different mindset. And that ultimately led to the restoration of the Paramount, the restoration of the Jefferson as live entertainment venues. You had Lee Danielson bring in the movie theater and the Ice Park, which was hugely controversial at the time. But again, you know, it's reasons for people to come downtown. And then ultimately, you know, Corin Capshaw, my employer, was able to strike the deal to put the pavilion in where the old Fridays After Five stage had been. And that, you know, opened a world of possibilities for, you know, truly national performing artists to come and play right downtown. So I think there's an argument to be made that, you know, that the live music scene as part of the broader art scene really was the driving force for creating what the downtown mall is today.
You've been listening to Sunday Morning Wake Up Call host Rick Moore's May Conversation with Rich Tarbell, Kirby Hutto, and Stephen Barling about the impact of local music on the development of the downtown mall. On this, our season finale, we're taking a look back at three of our shows from 2019. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Stream us live online at 947wpvc.org or on your mobile device via TuneIn. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. After the break, my October conversation with University of Virginia Director of Cybersecurity and IT Programs, Angela Orbaugh, about the security threats facing the Internet today and what can be done about them. Please stay with us. In October, I talked with University of Virginia Director of Cybersecurity and IT Programs, Angela Orbaugh, about some of the security threats facing the Internet today and what can be done about them. I began by asking Angela how she came to work in the cybersecurity field.
Kind of this progression that actually started, I'd say, all the way back in maybe about 7th or 8th grade. I took a class, a computer class, in 8th grade. The only thing you could do on this old computer at this point in time was write in BASIC code. So we learned how to program in BASIC. We learned how to write a number guessing game between 1 and 10. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. You can do that? And so that originally sparked my interest in computing in general. As I progressed into college, then I took a course on computer networking. So I learned how zeros and ones could be used to communicate from one computer to another computer, even in different buildings. And I thought, wow, you can do that? That's really cool. So I eventually moved my career after undergrad into database programming and then on into the field of networking. Once I was in the field of networking, I started to learn more about security in general. I learned that you could break into computers. I learned that you could manipulate those zeros and ones as they traversed between two computers. And once again, my thought was, wow, you can do that? And so that was what really got me into security. I just started reading as much as I could about it, learning as much as I could. Now, also, this was during the time of about the mid to late 90s. So there were a lot of things happening security-wise at that point. A lot of viruses, a lot of worms. It was starting to hit the main media. And I feel like that's where a lot of people's interest was really sparked during that time.
Did you think that the cybersecurity field was a growing concern, that this was an escalating kind of thing that would keep you busy for many years?
I didn't think it would grow as it has now with over 1 million unfilled jobs globally. I didn't know it would get that big.
Right.
But I did know as long as we had computing, we were going to have the need for cybersecurity experts.
You're also the author of several books. Talk to us about how you got started as an author.
Sure. I really enjoy just trying to share information and educate others. And I was at the time, this was around 2003, I was already teaching on the training circuit on the industry side in cybersecurity. And a few of my colleagues were starting to get into writing and authoring some books. And I thought, you know, that might be something that I would enjoy doing. So I talked with a publisher, and I was able to work with them to actually publish my first book, which was about a tool, a security tool called Ethereal at the time. Now it's called Wireshark. By the time it was called Ethereal. And it's a tool that allows you to watch those ones and zeros as they traverse from one computer to the other. So I started out by writing a book telling others, here's how you use this tool. Here's how you can use it to analyze your networks and to keep things secure. And things moved on from that. When all was said and done, I was either co-authored or primary authored on 6 books.
Talk about your work at the University of Virginia.
The University of Virginia, I'm an assistant professor there, so I teach cybersecurity both at the undergraduate level and at the graduate level. We have a graduate level certificate program. It's a 6-course certificate. And we have an undergraduate certificate and also an undergraduate concentration within our bachelor's degree completion program. So I actually helped create that undergraduate concentration in the bachelor's degree completion program. We just rolled that out this semester, actually, officially, and we've already gotten a lot of interest. I have a lot of new students in that program. So I enjoy teaching both at the undergraduate and the graduate level. Now, I am also the program director for those programs, both cybersecurity and IT. We also have an undergraduate IT certificate and an undergraduate concentration in the bachelor's degree completion program as well.
Now, the Internet's been around for 30-plus years, I think. I don't know when it officially began, but it's around 30 years ago. Why has this become such a big problem now? How did we get from where we were to here?
Well, we've had problems all along. We just have more now because more types of devices are on the Internet. Back in the old days, we had mainframes on the Internet. We didn't have as many users. We still had attacks. You know, Cliff Stoll's Cuckoo's Egg is all about one of the first attacks. It's a really great book. I recommend everyone to read that. That was one of the first books I read when I got interested into security. But now we have everything from our refrigerators to our watches to our tablets and our cell phones all connecting up to the Internet. So there are many, many more devices for attackers to attack. There's a lot more low-hanging fruit that makes it a lot easier these days.
Is a part of it that we just built everything so fast? Windows, the Internet, our protocols? Or was it just that at the time these things were built, we just didn't think about security the way we do now?
Definitely, product makers were not thinking about security. That's one of the things that I've been teaching now for over 2 decades, is that we need to be building security in. We need to be building security into the design of our products, the design of our infrastructure. We need to be building security into our coding. And that just was not happening at the beginning at all. Then security kind of became a patch, you know, a Band-Aid that we put on later, an add-on. Now we're finally getting to the point in some areas where security is taken seriously and it is being built in. But sometimes I feel like that whole cycle, anytime there's a new movement in the area, that whole cycle starts all over again. You know, we had mainframes. Once we were able to get security pretty well in place for mainframes, we moved into servers, then we moved into desktops, then we moved into things like voice over IP. Now we've moved into all kinds of smart devices. Every time we've moved into one of those new eras, as I call it, I feel like we're almost starting over again.
In other words, you're saying we're making the same mistakes again with the new technology as we made 30 years ago with mainframes.
Exactly. We're not learning from our past.
Is a part of that just the rush to market?
It is exactly rush to market. Yeah. I teach, one of the courses that I teach at the graduate level is securing the Internet of Things. And that is essentially the theme of that course, is that fact that there are so many problems in these smart types of devices is because of the rush to market.
Sure.
It's just not getting built in.
Sure. We're going to introduce a few technical terms as we go through the hour. We're going to try to keep that to a minimum. But one of the ones I wanted to talk about was the word hacker. And the word hacker has... The meaning of the word hacker has evolved over time. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Prior to the beginning of the 80s, a hacker could be a computer programmer or just someone who uses their technology know-how to solve problems and to fix things. or maybe even to create things, as in the case of a computer programmer. Around the early to mid 80s, though, hackers started becoming used in the mainstream media as more of a negative term in terms of security hackers, the bad guys, the intruders, the attackers, and it really just caught on. You know, I still consider myself a hacker. I consider many of my friends a hacker when we use our technology know-how to fix things, but we're certainly not bad guy hackers.
Which brings me to the question, what's the difference between a black hat and a white hat hacker?
So right after the term hacker started being used in the media, and a lot of folks were not so happy about that, those particular pieces of the terminology came out to start distinguishing things. A black hat hacker is the bad guy, basically someone who's trying to break into a computer, steal data, you know, do something they shouldn't be doing. White hats, on the other hand, know all of the same techniques, but they're working for good. So maybe they're working for a security company and they're testing security defenses of a client or their organization that they work for, doing all of the same types of techniques, but on the good side. Now, the white hats are also protecting organizations against the black hats. Then you have that fun little space in the middle, the gray hats, folks that might want to dabble into some of the black arts, the dark arts from the Harry Potter world, but they also try to live on the good side as well.
So in the movies, frequently black hat hackers are converted to white hat hackers for some industrial purpose. Does that really happen?
It can be seen as happening. It depends on the black hat hacker, and it is all kind of gray. Even the black hat, the white hat is all kind of gray. But there are certainly very technically savvy hackers out there who may not work for large corporations or industry that do get recruited for certain types of work.
Right. Director of Cybersecurity and IT Programs at the University of Virginia, Angela Oba, is here with us talking about cybersecurity and the Internet. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I wanted to spend a little bit more time on this one because this one seems to be the biggest one. It's in the news. You mentioned it earlier, and that's ransomware. Talk a little bit. Let's start off with, what is a ransomware attack?
Right. So it was the city of Baltimore, but many organizations, hospitals, companies, even individuals like yourself or myself, we could all be susceptible to ransomware. And ransomware, to me, is one of those things that's so bad, but I also thought, wow, I can't believe no one thought of this before now.
Right.
Basically, a malicious software program, maybe you clicked on one of those links in your email that you didn't think about. It looked legitimate. Now you have malicious software installed on your computer that you don't know about. That malicious software will take all of the data on your computer and encrypt it so you can't get to it. It essentially puts a big padlock on your computer for you, virtual in the virtual sense,
right,
so that you can't even get to any of your data. It'll pop up a nice bright screen to tell you that this has happened, that your system has been locked down with ransomware, and that in order to unlock it and get access to your data again, you'll need to pay a certain amount of money. Usually this money, they ask for it in Bitcoin. So they actually give you instructions on how to get the Bitcoin and pay. The funny thing about this kind of attack is there's actually tech support. There's tech support to help walk you through the entire process so that you know how to buy Bitcoin and transfer it to the attacker, and then that you know how to get your data unlocked.
Now, you said a few minutes ago that this is big business, and you're not kidding.
I'm not kidding. Yeah. You're talking, for a general user like you and I, for our home computer, they may ask for, you know, $300, $400 maybe. My father-in-law actually fell for this. He had this happen.
Right.
And he called me up and said, what do I do? I said, well, what'd you have on the computer? And it was his personal computer. It was a lot of family photos, a lot of personal data for some volunteer organizations that he helps with. And I said, if you want it back, you pay. That's what you do. If you didn't have it backed up, because he didn't have it backed up, he decided not to pay. He didn't want to play that game.
Right.
So he just ended up losing that data. Now, if you're talking a larger organization, like I mentioned, Baltimore City, the amount was about $76,000. Hospitals have been known to pay tens of thousands of dollars to get the data back. So it ranges. But you know what? You can bargain.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You can negotiate and try to get that amount down.
Wow. talk to their tech support, huh?
Right.
are these attacks primarily on PCs and Macs, or do they affect smartphones and other devices as well?
So far, they've largely been hitting PCs. Macs are not immune. There is ransomware for Mac out there, and it's traversing the internet, making its rounds. And smartphones will be next. So they are not immune as well. But right now, it is mostly in the PC space.
And when you say PCs, you're referring to people running the Windows operating
yes.
system. The people running Linux, are they more prone or less prone?
Just the, kind of falls into the same category as Mac. They're not immune. It's just that Mac and Linux, for example, much less market share. It's, even now, Mac is growing. Lots of people have Macs, sure. but it's still comparatively way more PCs running right. Windows out there. So
it's the low-hanging fruit.
The low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, again,
exactly.
It's just easy. You write one program, services many different customers, in quotation marks.
It's so more bang for your buck.
Yeah, exactly. Are there any estimates at all on the overall size of the ransomware business?
Overall, I've seen numbers thrown around in the billions, for sure. Like I said, this organized cybercrime is big, big money. And so I've seen lots of numbers well over $1 billion market. And that's why one of the questions a lot of people ask me is, well, if I paid these folks, you know, they might not give me that key to unlock my data. Actually, they do. They want to make good on their sale, because if they start not making good on their sale, people aren't going to pay. Now they're losing business. So by making good on their sale, then they know that they've got a, quote, good reputation, and they can continue to make more money this way.
That sounds surprising. I guess that's kind of brand recognition in a way.
Yes, it is.
In a kind of backwards kind of way.
And ransomware has gotten so kind of popular on the black hat side that you can purchase ransomware as a service. So if you're not the computer attacker kind of person, but you want to target someone with ransomware, you can go onto the dark web. That's the part of the internet. I kind of refer to it as like the back alley of the internet. And you can purchase it as a service and have someone else do it.
Wow, that's amazing. So what is the most common way it comes through?
Ransomware is usually clicking on something you shouldn't be clicking on.
I see.
My father-in-law's case, I believe he got an email that looked legitimate about something, and he clicked on it thinking that it was, and that's how he was able to download the malicious software in the background, and he didn't even know that was happening until it popped up the big bright screen and told him.
Right. I guess my last question, well, I have two more questions on ransomware. One is, it sounds like it was really Bitcoin that made this possible, because before Bitcoin, there was no untraceable way to exchange money. Is that true?
It certainly does help. And like I said earlier, when I said, I wonder why no one thought about this before, and that's probably the reason why, is because what are you going to do? Give them your credit card number? I mean, it's a lot easier to trace.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it can be done, though, without Bitcoin, for sure. You can, a lot of the ways that the attackers get to money is through prepaid debit cards and things like that. So the attacker could ask you to purchase these prepaid debit cards and then just give them the number over phone or over email, over their tech support, whatever it may be. That happens a lot as well. You know, when your credit cards are stolen, they're not always, when your credit card numbers are stolen, they're not always used to just take your number and then go out and purchase something. What happens is they take your number, they go out and they purchase these prepaid credit cards. They use the prepaid credit cards then to go into places like, you know, Best Buy or something like that, buy big ticket items, computers, TVs, or whatever. They take the big ticket items, sell them on Craigslist, then they're walking away with cold hard cash in their hands.
Wow, it's like an automatic money laundering system.
Yeah,
almost, really.
It's an entire process. So they could do that same type of thing and still get money from you on ransomware by using the prepaid debit cards and gift cards.
Wow. We'd mentioned Bitcoin a couple of times in passing, and I just wanted to spend a little bit more time on that, because seems that it's had a lot to do, especially with ransomware attacks. Tell us a little bit about Bitcoin. How did it get started? What is it?
Sure. Bitcoin is a digital currency. So you can actually go to certain sites and you can purchase Bitcoin that was originally backed up with real money. But it then becomes all digital. It's all in the digital realm. And that can be used for different things. You know, some companies actually do accept Bitcoin. I heard at one point that I thought you could buy a Tesla with Bitcoin. Not sure if you still can. And so a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin is actually a really good thing. It's protected by cryptography. There's a lot of ledger systems built into it. for exchange and transfer. So cryptocurrency is going to open up a whole new world for us eventually in the technology sector. Right now, though, the attackers know that as well. So certainly they're using it to make their job a lot easier when it comes to things like collecting money for ransomware.
So if I needed some Bitcoin, let's say I want to pay off my ransomware attacker, how do I go about converting real money on my credit card, say?
There's many different sites where you can do that, and that's why the attackers will certainly walk you through how to do that.
And these sites you refer to, are they reputable, safe sites to, would they just take your money and not give you the Bitcoin?
No, some of them are definitely reputable and safe. Like I said, you can even buy certain products in Bitcoin these days. So some of them are. Now, if you are going to some on what's known as the dark web, for example, they might not be. They might be attacker sites just pretending to sell Bitcoin to you to take your money and run.
That was my October interview with University of Virginia Director of Cybersecurity and IT Programs, Angela Orbaugh, about some of the security threats facing the Internet today and what can be done about them. On this, our season finale, we've taken a look back at three of our shows from 2019. That's it for this week and this season. This and every episode of The Wake Up Call is available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Coming up at noon on 94.7 WPVC, it's El Club del Sabor. Join us next Sunday at 11 a.m. when host Rick Moore returns with guest Katie Cavalry and attorney Doris Geldman. They'll be talking about law, care, and resources for the elderly. For the Wake Up Call, I'm Dan Gould. Thanks for listening. This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Engineering assistance was by Mike Friend. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.